The title of the talk is One Sangha, Building the Buddha Land in 2017. So when Hannah asked me if I'd give this talk during the event on the theme of One Sangha, the first thing that came to my mind was remembering being on my ordination retreat. And I was laying on my back in the sunshine reading a book that Bante wrote called The Inconceivable Emancipation. And it's a book of lectures that he gave in 1979 on a Mahayana text called the Vimalakirti Nidesha. And I was reading this book and I could hear him delivering the lectures as I read it, and his voice was completely fired up with energy and with inspiration. And I've heard about that series of lectures. They're famous for Bante being on fire in that time. So I was tuned into that spirit at Akashavana. But what made me think of it was that there's one particular incident in the first chapter of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, and that's what I want to talk to you about today. So I'm going to be referring to this lecture that Bante gave called Building the Buddha Land, and I'm going to begin by telling you a story. So at one time, the Buddha Shakyamuni was dwelling in a park near Vaishali, a city in ancient India, and the park had been donated to him by one of his followers called Amarapali. And on full moon nights and during the rainy season retreat, the Buddha would retreat there, and a whole gathering of disciples would gather around him to hear him teach. So the Mahayana Sutras are a particular body of text in the Buddhist tradition that are well known for being cosmic and mythic and doing things on the grandest possible scale. So on this occasion, there were 8,000 arahants there. Their minds were entirely liberated. They were freed from all impurities. There were 32,000 bodhisattvas, beings dedicated to the attainment of enlightenment for the benefit of all beings over innumerable lifetimes. There were also gathered gods of many kinds. So there were 10,000 Brahmas, there were 12,000 Shakras, there were Devas, there were Lokapalas, there were Nagas, there were Yakshas, Gandharvas, Asuras, Garudas, Kimnaras, and Maharagas, and Dakas and Dakinis, and finally the community of monks, nuns, and lay followers. I've got no idea what most of those beings are, but you get the sense of an assembly of diversity, I suppose, actually. So the Buddha's sitting on a majestic throne in Amarapali's park before this vast assembly, and they've come to hear him teach the Dharma. But before he can begin, another 500 people turn up. And these are 500 youths from a tribal village near Vaishali called Lichavi. So there are 500 Lichavi youths who arrive, and they're led by the bodhisattva called Ratnakara. And each one of the Lichavi youths are carrying a parasol. So a parasol is like an umbrella, a kind of material umbrella. And each one of these parasols is uniquely jeweled and adorned. Each one of them is colourful and distinct in its own way. And they circumambulate the Buddha, so they walk around him, and then they each approach him and offer up their individual parasol. And the Buddha receives their offerings, and he transforms these 500 parasols into a single precious canopy. And the canopy covers the entire billion world system. All world systems, all universes are reflected in the interior of the canopy. All of the suns and moons, all of the living beings, and all of the Buddhas teaching the Dharma. And the Buddha's voices can be heard echoing from the canopy. And this gathering of disciples that were assembled before the Buddha, they were inspired and delighted to witness this miracle. So this is the image of one Sangha that came to my mind. And it's an image of a unified spiritual community. So in his 1979 talk, Bante, he draws out the significance of this incident and tells us about the imagery of the sutra, and I'm going to come back to that a bit later. But for now, I want to travel from ancient India to the UK in 2017, and specifically to Wembley Arena, which is a concert venue in London where I went to see Bob Dylan play last month. Does anyone not know who Bob Dylan is? Good. I thought I'd check, given we're a slightly different generation. So Bob Dylan is an American writer, singer, and musician. And for me, he holds a bit of an archetype. So he holds a sort of vision of a poet and of a prophet and of a truth speaker, someone who speaks the truth. And in the 60s, he wrote a number of protest songs, which gave expression to the youthful idealism and the political ferment of the time, particularly related to the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. So he's now 75, and I went to see him play last month, and I found it a really moving experience, actually. And it reminded me a little bit of the Buddha having his first experience of old age, sickness and death in the story of the Four Sights. And I don't think that this was actually the first time that the Buddha had witnessed old age, sickness and death, but I think it stands in for those moments when impermanence or dukkha really touches us and we really know it for the first time. So it felt a bit like this. And it was interesting because he didn't say a single word throughout the whole concert. He just played song after song. He never really even took centre stage, and he never addressed the audience or spoke to us. And I felt a bit frustrated by this. I really wanted him to speak, and I really wanted him to say something revolutionary. And I think I particularly wanted him to say something that would address the political situation in the UK at the moment, indeed in the whole of Europe. But then, looking around me in this stadium, which holds about 12,000 people, I wondered whether if he had said something, how it would have been received. So looking around me, the audience had all grown old with him. They were mainly in their 50s and 60s. And I imagined that the majority of them had settled down and were living fairly conventional lives now. Perhaps the same could be said of Bob Dylan in a way. And I imagined the difference between that audience and the audience that he would have been playing to in the 60s and 70s. And I just thought that they were probably a world apart. There was one man who was sitting in front of me who stood out a little bit. He was wearing an old rough biker jacket, and he had a long grey ponytail, and he was just rocking backwards and forwards to the beat of the music, and he didn't miss a single beat the whole night. But his expression didn't change. He was just very serious, just kind of there listening to the music. And I imagined that he was probably a serious fan, and that he'd grown old with Bob Dylan. So then at one point, Bob Dylan began to sing Blowing in the Wind. Do you all know that? I'm just going to read a few of the lines from it. How many times must the cannonballs fly before they are forever banned? How many years can some people exist before they are allowed to be free? How many deaths will it take until he knows that too many people have died? So I began to cry listening to this song, and I just felt deeply sad, actually. I looked up later, and the song was first released in 1963, so that's 4 years before Tree Ratna began. Bob Dylan was 21, and all those years have passed, and still the questions seemed painfully relevant. Still, they hadn't been answered. And I felt sad because I had a sense of an idealism, a youthful idealism, being unfulfilled, and a vision to change the world being unsatisfied. Samsara rolls on. So the whole evening felt like a witnessing of the sights of old age, sickness and death. Samsara is endless. Bob Dylan will die, and you and I will die too. So 4 years after he released Blowing in the Wind, Triratna began. And 12 years later, Bhante delivered this lecture on building the Buddha land in 1979. Was anyone here born in 1979? No. So it was 12 years before I was born. And recently we celebrated the 50th anniversary of Triratna at Adisthana. And we held a sort of weekend celebratory event. And on the first evening, we watched some old documentary footage of the beginnings of the Triratna community. There were young, idealistic hippies tripping out on acid, dancing madly around a garden. There was a sense of wildness and a revolutionary spirit, a radical movement to build a new society, to build a Buddha land. So there was a positive energy and vision alongside a sense of naivety and inexperience. And the films really got a sense of the times that the community was founded and grew in. And I do recommend watching them. They're available online. So in 2017, we live in a different world from that. And I don't know about you, but often in response to global, social, political, environmental issues, I just feel completely powerless. And I feel ineffective. The world feels bigger, we're more globally connected, and that's a positive thing because it gives conditions for events like this to happen. And it also gives a greater appreciation of difference and diversity. But it can also feel, there's an expression in English about being a little fish in a big pond, or a little fish in an ocean even. So the forces of opposition feel stronger. For instance, the power that the media wields to confuse, to distort, and to distract us from truth. The influence of capitalist ideals on the governance of our countries, where business and profit and power are put before human values of generosity, love, and simplicity. And with more information, the issues that we face become more complex, and it feels harder to discern what the truth is. So I do find this world a scary place to be, actually, and I don't understand it. And I can feel like I've lived past the age of idealism, where it was possible to live with a really deep conviction that it was possible to change the world. So these were the kind of reflections that I was having when I began to prepare to speak to you today. And I noticed that if I'm not careful, without awareness and a sense of metta, these reflections can become the basis for doubt or for apathy or for inaction, rather than a basis for faith, inspiration and going for refuge. Which made me think that the first three sights of old age, sickness and death aren't enough. We need a vision as well. We need the fourth sight, we need the vision of the holy life. We need the vision of a life gone forth. So, what has this all got to do with being one Sangha? And what has it got to do with the story from the Vimalakirti Nadesha? The vision that Bhante offers us in building the Buddha land is timeless. The offering of the individual parasols and their transformation into a single canopy provides a vision of what is possible when you create spiritual community, which is the building of a Buddha land right here. I'm going to steal a line from Pranyaketu now. So changing the world does not mean the creation of a utopian vision. It's more immediate than that. Changing the world does not mean the creation of a utopian vision, a paradise somewhere in the future. It's right now. And this story from the Vimalakirti Nadesha illustrates this timeless principle, this timeless principle of the Dharma, that when you get a group of true individuals who are going for refuge, the bodhicitta will arise. So the bodhicitta is the bodhi heart, the heart or mind intent on awakening for the benefit of all beings. It's also sometimes translated as the urge or the will to enlightenment. So the bodhisattva, the being in which the bodhicitta arises and flows, makes four vows. Though the many beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Though greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly, I vow to cut them off. Though the Dharma is vast and fathomless, I vow to understand it. Though the Buddha's way is beyond attainment, I vow to embody it fully. So these are the four bodhisattva vows. And I love them because they express the impossibility of the task. So beings are numberless, greed, hatred, and delusion is endless, the Dharma is vast and fathomless, and the Buddha's way is beyond attainment. And yet, we choose to act and be driven by this vision nonetheless. So Bante says about the bodhisattva's vows, "These magnificent, awe-inspiring vows may seem like a tall order, to say the least. What we have to understand is that there is not really any question of the ordinary, limited self taking these vows, as though it were making them a part of itself. It's more than that. In the taking of these vows, the ordinary self opens itself up to the forces of wisdom and compassion, which they represent, allowing itself to be inspired and transformed by them, allowing wisdom and compassion to work through it." So it's not possible for us, from our present perspective, to take these vows. But it is the most beautiful and vast ideal which we can open up to, the bodhisattva ideal. So it feels like samsara is endless, and it feels like it's impossible to change the world from my present point of view. But I will put myself in service of this vision anyway, and I'll allow myself to be transformed by the taking of that vision. So I was interested yesterday in the conversation cafe, the idea of dissolving borders and overcoming boundaries came up. So we have the choice to step beyond borders, both externally and internally, and we're exemplifying that together this weekend. We have the choice to act generously from a sense of abundance, rather than trying to accumulate and protect our own resources. We have the choice to act with a greater consciousness, with more awareness and love rather than fear, defensiveness and isolation. We have the choice to empathize across difference and create harmony rather than division and prejudice. And we have the choice to be receptive to the Dharma, to the way that all experience reveals reality. And each time we choose to act from this deeper openness and step out into freedom beyond our limited, ordinary conception of ourselves, every time we act from that basis, we're acting from a basis of bodhicitta. And these actions perfume the world and they create a Buddha land right here. So bodhicitta is a synthesis of wisdom and compassion, and it encompasses both the individual and collective aspects of going for refuge. So what this means is that individually, we do need to have a depth of spiritual practice. We really need to see the nature of samsaric experience as impermanent, insubstantial, and limited. And we need to begin to see the nature of reality as open, unbounded, satisfying, and beautiful. And we can only see this for ourselves in our own experience. No one else can go for refuge for us. So this is the individual aspect. But we also do need to be engaged with others. We need to be in connection with others because this also is an expression of reality. It's an expression of our interconnectedness. And it's where we get a lived sense of stepping beyond self and other in our daily life. We need to be true individuals, but we need to be in association. So one sangha is actually the path as well as the goal. It's what we practice as well as what we aspire to. And in the Vimalakirti Nisesha, the individual parasols, they represent the bodhicitta arising within each individual. They represent their aspirations to enlightenment, to freedom, to openness, their aspirations to transform themselves and be of benefit to all beings. They represent their aspirations to practice the Brahma Viharas and the Sangha Vastus. And as each one of these individual parasols is offered up to the Buddha, their aspirations converge and unify, laid down at the feet of the Buddha. So travelling back from Amarapali's park in Vaishali to the Buddhistisches Tor Berlin, each of us here have our own individual parasol or petal. We're a diverse gathering, each bringing our own conditions and our own personalities. And we'll each have a very personal and unique story about how we encountered the Dharma. There'll be something which we've responded to and which has drawn us on. It might be an aspect of enlightenment or a quality of the Buddha. It might be a particular teaching, or it might be an experience we've had of Sangha. And this quality is reflected in the midst of our own life. So it's something which we respond to, which touches us, which we long for and which we aspire to. And like the Lichavi youths, and like the Triratna youths of the 60s and 70s, we are unified by our going for refuge to the Three Jewels. We offer up our petal to the Buddha, and it's the Buddha that transforms the single petals into the thousand-petaled lotus. So in The Inconceivable Emancipation, Bhante says of this, "It could signify that to the extent that our spiritual aspirations have a common object, they will be united. And to the extent that they are united, they will be a force for good in the world. It could signify that to the extent that our spiritual aspirations have a common object, they will be united. And to the extent that they are united, they will be a force for good in the world." So the Buddha offers a vision of existence to these Lichavi youths. The single canopy represents an experience that's beyond the self and beyond other. It's not collective and it's not individual either. And Bhante says that it belongs to a third mysterious category. And this is the true spiritual community. It's beyond a sense of self and other. And a true spiritual community can be a force for good in the world. So today is the first anniversary of my public ordination. It was a year ago today that with 15 other women, I was publicly ordained in Spain and given the name Akasajoti. And there are two parts to the ordination in Triratna. So first of all, we have the private ordination, and that just takes place between me and my private preceptor, Vajratara. And this is where we offer up our individual parasol. It's where we take the refuges and precepts, and we're introduced to a figure who embodies that personal connection with enlightenment, but which also goes beyond that. And then the second bit of the ordination is the public ordination. So it's in this ordination that we recite the four lines of acceptance that Prasadacharin spoke about. And this is where we join the order. This is where we join the spiritual community, the people with whom we're going to be practicing. And these lines of acceptance, they can be seen as our version of the Bodhisattva vows. At my private ordination, the bit that I enjoyed the most, which surprised me actually, was taking the refuges and precepts from Vajratara and just repeating them after her. And the bit that I was looking forward to the most and waiting for was to recite the lines of acceptance after my public preceptor, Parami. And actually, I think on some level, this was the whole reason for me wanting to be ordained, was just to be able to say these words, these kind of impossible words. So, our ordination into the Triratna Order includes both of these aspects, the private and the public, the individual and the collective. And with the order and with the Triratna community, Sangharakshita has offered us a vision of existence. He's offered us a myth which we can participate in. And though we are not the hippies of the 60s and 70s, the bodhicitta is timeless. But its expression does need to remain responsive and alive to the current world situation. It is a different world from 50 years ago. And I don't really know what it means to be idealistic now. What does it mean to be radical and revolutionary in 2017? How do we keep a wild and untamed spirit alive amongst us? What will it look like? What form our idealism takes, I don't know, but it is a question that I want all of us to be asking. So in another of his lectures, also on the theme of building a new world, Bhante says, looked at in this way, a blueprint for a new world is a quite different subject, inasmuch as that new world does not exist yet. If it exists at all, it exists only in the imagination, only as a dream. But it is no less worthy of our attention because of that. The imagination, after all, has its uses. What we imagine today, we may do tomorrow. The dream of the night may become the reality of the morning. Let us imagine, let us dream, and we may find that we are closer to reality than we had thought. So let us imagine, let us dream, and we may find that we are closer to reality than we had thought. So I'm just going to end as I began with a story. So at one time, the Buddha, Shakyamuni, was dwelling in a converted hospital building in the district of Kreuzberg in the city of Berlin. The building had been envisioned by a Mogaratna and fundraised for by the Berlin Sangha. And on full moon nights and during rainy season retreats and during the Kreuzberg Carnival, the great gathering of disciples would form around him to hear him teach. So on this occasion, rather modestly for a Mahayana Sutra, there were just 70 beings, 70 youths from 9 different lands, speaking in at least 10 different tongues, with many hundreds of positive qualities amongst them. With connections across the whole of the world system named mainland Europe. So the Buddha is sitting on a majestic lotus throne in the Berlin Buddhistisches Tor before this relatively small and exclusive gathering who have come to hear the Dharma. And one evening they sit together before the Buddha and they recite verses in praise of him. They chant thousands of mantras, which carry up through the air, out through the small open window above them. All throughout Kreuzberg and beyond, to Südstern, to Mitte, to Prenzlauer Berg even, their voices can be heard echoing through the streets. Each of these European youths carries a lotus petal. Each one is uniquely jeweled and adorned, each one colourful and distinct. They offer up their individual petal to the Buddha, and the Buddha receives their offerings, and he magically transforms these 70 lotus petals into a single 1,000-petaled lotus flower, which takes root in Berlin and blossoms over the whole of the mainland European world system.